This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Infertility affects 1 in 8 couples in the United States. That's according to Resolve, the National Infertility Association. But despite the high numbers, many keep their struggle quite private. For many years, writer Belle Boggs was one of those people. She and her husband experienced a wide range of emotional and financial obstacles in the 5 years they spent trying to get pregnant. But it wasn't until Belle wrote about it publicly that she realized how many of her friends and family were in the same boat. This journey inspired her new book, The Art of Waiting, on Fertility, Medicine, and Motherhood. It's part memoir, part cultural history. Belle Boggs is an English professor at NC State University, and she joins me in the studio today. Welcome to the State of Things, Belle. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's so nice to be here. I'm a big fan of your show.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm becoming a fan of your work. This is part cultural history and part memoir, and so it brings together a lot of aspects of this issue. Let me start with the personal and ask you about it. You first wrote about your struggle with infertility in about 2012, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that piece.
Well, I started writing the piece in 2011. It takes a while to get to print for Orion magazine. And it was really one of the first significant nonfiction pieces I'd undertaken. I'm a fiction writer. Mm. And I was interested in writing for Orion. I'd been approached by one of the editors there. And I admired so much their essayists. People like Rebecca Solnit, for example, and I was really interested in trying to do some type of essay for them. And the experience that I had, that I felt that I could write, that would be most meaningful to me, was the experience of infertility that I was going through and struggling with. And so I told them about my idea. And of course, it's a magazine very much about nature and place and culture. So, you know, I wanted to connect it also to the natural world. And I said, you know, I'm going to do some research and figure out if there are examples of infertility or subfertility in the animal world, maybe with non-human primates. And, you know, that sounds like kind of a – and I said, and maybe I'll write about some writers that I like too, and I'll write about my own experience, and I'll write about living along the Ha River. And, you know, I'm sure it was a terrible pitch, but my editor really kindly went along with me and stuck with me while I worked on the piece. And I was lucky to be able to interview really incredible scientists at Duke, like Leslie Digby, who's done this incredible, interesting work with marmosets, and also to visit the North Carolina Zoo, where we have this amazing gorilla troop that has been so reproductively successful, and then also to think about my own experience of waiting and struggling with the question of, first of all, how is, if I ever became successful and had a child, how that would affect my you know, emerging career as a writer, and also how far would I go with treatment? At that time, I was not doing any. My husband and I were not pursuing IVF. We thought we would never do IVF, but we were also going to a support group where we knew other people who were, and so we were trying to decide. And writing this book helped me decide what to do.
IVF is in vitro fertilization, and so you talk about that and the journey. Talk about, so we've got a few things to pull apart here. Certainly want to get into your research, both culturally and biologically, but the decision to go public with this, was it a difficult decision?
You know, I guess not. In some ways, I'm a shy person. But I'm also a friendly person. So I like talking to other people, and I like finding out their stories. And once you start, finding out about the stories of other people, you feel committed to them and invested in them, and you want to take their stories to others. And you know, I've been a writer, you know, pretty much my whole life, and so I love writing. That's the thing that I love doing best. And so having the control of being able to put it on the page is, you know, more comfortable for me than, for example, doing an interview on the radio.
Well, you're doing well so far. Your husband, you and your husband tried for 5 years before you became pregnant with your daughter. Take us through that journey and what, you know, where you began.
Sure. So we started with just my OBGYN, and you know, we kind of I went to her, and Sad. We've been having trouble. We had thought we would be pregnant by now. It had been more than a year since we'd started trying. And I took for a while some oral medication, and that a lot of people start with. And I think I took that oral medication for too long, months and months and months of, I think, 9 months or something, or maybe 8 months of this oral medication. And it was not successful. And then it was when we moved to a reproductive endocrinologist's office at UNC Fertility that we started getting more specialized treatment. And we started with a lower tech, less expensive form of treatment, intrauterine insemination combined with medication, and had a wonderful experience with our doctor there. But we really couldn't afford IVF. So many people can't afford it because it's not covered by insurance for many of us. It was not covered for us. There are only 15 states that mandate coverage of infertility. And among those states, they don't all, they don't all cover mandate coverage in the same way. So for us, we had to save a lot of money in order to be able to afford to do IVF the way that we wanted to, which was with a commitment to possibly not being successful the first time, and also with single embryo transfer, which at the time was that we were finally pursuing IVF, was pretty rare for my age group. And
what's the alternative?
The alternative is to transfer a couple of embryos. Mm-hmm. Our doctor was very safe, and I'm sure he's safe with all of his patients, but the safest way is single embryo transfer, because you reduce the risk of twins, mm-hmm. both for the embryos, eventually fetuses and babies, and also for the mother's health.
So you went through it and you talked about it. It's obviously a financial burden. It's also emotionally taxing and physically. So tell us more about those aspects of IVF.
Yeah, infertility is emotionally very isolating for some of the reasons that you mentioned. It's not something that we're comfortable talking about openly, because it makes people uncomfortable, partially because they assume that it's about, many people assume that it's about the female body, and culturally we're a little bit uncomfortable still with the female body not working as we think it should. And although we also know that infertility is as much as often a male problem as it is a female problem. It's that experience of isolation is really hard. I think you also mentioned, I didn't realize that I had friends who were going through exactly the same thing that I was going through at the same time, and I didn't know it because we didn't talk about it, because I didn't talk about it. There's a phrase that I came across in some of my research. I was talking to the therapist, Marnie Rosner, who's done this tremendous study of women who did not conceive through fertility treatment and also chose to live childlessly. And then their patterns of recovery, that's her study. And she talks about the phrase disenfranchised grief and how it can apply to infertility. And the way she defines it is, it's grief for a loss that cannot be openly acknowledged, publicly mourned, or socially supported. When I read that and talked to her about it, I related instantly. That is part of the problem of infertility. When we are infertile, we don't, or when we're experiencing infertility, you don't want to rain on anybody else's parade. Right. You don't want to tell your friends who have, maybe not had the same troubles that you've had, because you don't want to make them feel bad.
Well, and the grief and the loss that you would experience is all wrapped up in our expectations, cultural, personal, perhaps biological. The language is inescapable. Obviously, if you set a goal for yourself, having children going through this process, words like success and failure are inevitable. You must use them. And yet, I would think it might be hard not to identify with those terms and think about yourself in the bigger picture in terms of being a success or being a failure and having children or not, right?
Absolutely. And it's amazing to think about the people we think of as great successes who confess to feeling like failures when their bodies didn't do what they thought their bodies should do, or when they didn't have the lives that that they'd imagined for themselves.
You have dipped into Virginia Woolf's diary to find out some of her anguish over this.
Yeah, I actually found the references to her diaries and some wonderful diary examples in Tilly Olson's book Silences, which is about the, you know, the silences, cultural and also very often economic, and then also silences of sexism that keep people from the page. And she writes in one of her chapters, I think it's The Damnation of Women, about how even as, you know, a lot of the book is about how difficult it is to be a working mother and working mother writer. And I can certainly relate to that. But she writes that it's not until the 20th century that we start to see in diaries that, and, you know, in these private expressions of grief from writers like Virginia Woolf. And so she quotes some of the most painful expressions. But then the amazing thing that is really hopeful is that, you know, Woolf comes to the realization that her writing is actually very sustaining. And she writes, "Children are nothing to this."
I'm talking to Belle Boggs. She's with me today talking about her new book, The Art of Waiting. She's going to be launching her book at the Center for Documentary Studies in Durham tomorrow at 6. Our conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking today with North Carolina writer and NC State English professor Belle Boggs, author of the new book, The Art of Waiting, on Fertility, Medicine, and Motherhood, part cultural history, part memoir. And we were just talking before the break about Virginia Woolf, a writer who was concerned about not having children, but also, you know, she believed early on that it was affecting her writing, that she couldn't be a good writer if she didn't have a child.
Well, she writes so much about families and family life, and we know she does it so well and so beautifully. I think in her diaries, it's suggested that she compares herself to others. She compares herself to her sister. And, you know, she thinks about that relationship, parent-child relationship to her mother. And so, you know, I think when you're having, you know, it's easy to have a lot of self-doubt as a writer, even if you are, you know, Virginia Woolf, I guess. But when that self-doubt is compounded by isolation or by these other things that you wanted that you feel that you can't have or that you can't have, I think it's even more painful.
And then you took a look at the film Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Again, another film that sort of in an oblique way looks at the childlessness. I mean, I think that was more symbolic in that relationship, but powerful and palpable as Edward Albee's play and then ultimately the movie.
Yeah, I love that play, and I've loved it since I first read it in college. I was a K-12 teacher for many years, and when I was teaching at the Hobridge School in Alamance County, North Carolina, we had the opportunity to take our students to a Playmakers production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So my students and my colleague Katie Christensen, her theater students, my students were AP English students, they read the play. We took them to see the production. And I remember really vividly sitting near them and watching them experience that play. And for my students in particular, it was really hard for them to understand that George and Martha's baby boy was not real, that he was a product of the imagination. They saw that creation as really transgressive. And so when we talked a lot about the play and how it resolves, they felt, you know, this was something that had to be done. The exposure of this untruth, the exposure of the illusion, living in reality, But then I remember seeing them brace themselves in Act Three for that, you know, that announcement, I've got a surprise for you, baby. And for me and for my husband, when we've talked about the play ourselves, you know, the life of the imagination is also really important. And I found myself, as I was teaching the play and thinking about it and watching it too, and also talking with my colleague Katie about it, that we, you know, there's something to be said for the life of the imagination. There's something to be said for those, you know, the private, you know, the secrets that a long married couple who maybe doesn't have children, that they have between them. And so I thought a lot about that. And so I was in a little, you know, I found myself thinking that even as I was supporting my students' interpretation of the play, too.
There's a tension there, too, because I think the film and the play shine a light on the tragedy of depending on false hopes and false
right.
dreams, many of them culturally imposed. I mean, I think this is part of it, that the imagination certainly can help us through very difficult times as we try to transport ourselves out of a sense of grief or trauma. On the other hand, when we're afflicted by culturally imposed expectations, and that becomes the root of our self, of our delusion and our false hope, it can lead to a lot of shouting and broken wine bottles.
It can. But there are these beautiful parts, too, yeah. to the things that they reveal about the way, you know, just the richness of their imagination that they've applied to that son, you know, that Martha even knows, you know, what kinds of treats she would have made for him, what kinds, you know, how he would have walked between them hand in hand, that I think is also really beautiful.
You also point to the film Raising Arizona as another way we can try to understand this issue.
Yeah, I love that movie, and I know a lot of people do too. And my husband and I, a long time ago, before, you know, we ever had any of these issues, before we were married, we actually dressed up as Hi and Ed, and you know, we both loved that movie. And what I came to love even more about it is that even though it starts with, in some ways, you know, this kind of madcap idea, and also in some ways a sort of stereotypical infertile couple. They're, you know,
yeah,
they're
you
really
should,
desperate. They're going to so Hi and Ed are this, you know, this couple, a sort of slightly reformed ex-con and a police officer who find that they can't conceive, and also because of Hi's past life of crime, also are not approved to adopt. They steal a baby because they figure that the couple they're stealing from, they have quints, so they figure, you know, they've got more than they can handle. And they give the baby back at the end. You know, it's their choice. And I really love the end scene of the film and the way that Hi imagines the future, because he imagines two things. You know, he imagines a future in which he and Ed are watching Nathan Jr. from afar as these sort of people who send presents at Christmas. But then he imagines this future far in the future when they are sitting down with, you know, a bunch of people, maybe their children, maybe their grandchildren. That's what it looks like. You know, he's not sure. And so it's this dual future, this, you know, dual possibility that is, I think, comforting and beautiful, and is kind of the way that I like to think about the future.
But it all points to the power of our imaginations to create these images for us and ideals that then become very difficult if we can't meet them. I mean, you talked about it being a teacher, K-12. You must have heard from kids, too, their ideas of what the ideal family should be or is.
Yeah, it's interesting that, first of all, you know, they think so much about their families. That's a very important narrative in their lives. But, and this is not universally true of my students, but many of my students, from when I was teaching in first grade to teaching in high school, so many of my students, the family lives that they imagined were very much like the families that they grew up in. They imagined that they would have their children at around the same time their parents started having children. They would have about the same number of kids as they had siblings, or, you know, as their parents had. And I did the same thing. I thought, you know, when I was younger, I thought that I would have two kids, and, you know, and I thought that I would have them younger. And that's not how my life turned out, but my life turned out wonderfully. And an interesting thing, too, is that, you know, even when, so you look at something like the gorillas that we have in North Carolina, and who had this very interesting reproductive history. I don't know if people know their stories as well as I do, but the we had a couple of amazing gorilla births in 2012. Jemani and Olympia both had infants within a few weeks of each other. And Jemani and Olympia both behaved after their infants were born in ways that their keepers told me really said something about how they'd grown up. So Jemani had grown up at a zoo where infant sharing was really common, and Olympia had grown up in a zoo where the other gorilla birth she saw was a birth of twins. And so when Olympia snatched Jemani's infant, Jemani thought, okay, well, she's probably going to give it back. But Olympia thought, well, you know, I should have two of these. I mean, we can't know the minds of gorillas, but that was how it seemed to their keepers. And so it became, you know, became a problem for a couple of days until they managed to get Jemani's infant back to her. And of course, luckily, they have happy stories. They still live in the same enclosure and are fine.
But you also found out a little bit more about that in terms of how in zoos, how much we've learned about fertility, infertility, and just raising and trying to bear young in captivity. I was interested to know that they were on birth control until they could find the right mates for them. I didn't realize that they were taking birth control.
I know. I didn't know that either until I started talking to the keepers and researching it. Because of the species survival plan, they have to find a genetically compatible mate. You know, we only have so many lowland gorillas in captivity. And so they have to go through testing to make sure that these two gorillas are compatible. And so that is how we wound up with these multiple gorilla pregnancies. They were the female gorillas were on birth control, the same birth control humans take. And then they, you know, once they were cleared for breeding, they were taken off birth control, and they were remarkably reproductively successful.
You discovered other paradoxes in the rest of the natural world. Marmosets, for instance, is kind of fascinating in the way they the way hierarchies work, reproduction, and even sharing in that community, in those communities.
Right. So marmosets, I learned from Professor Digby at Duke, they have they work very cooperatively. It's hard to be a marmoset. It's a really small South American monkey, and their infants take a lot of care. I think that marmosets have twins. And so the way that their reproduction works is that typically only one female marmoset in a group can get pregnant at a time. And so this is called reproductive suppression. The other marmosets, they either just don't breed, or there's this neuroendocrine response that it inhibits ovulation. And
it appears to be related to the pregnancy of another female.
Exactly.
Right?
Wow. So this other marmoset, the kind of, you know, the matriarchal marmoset will continue to breed and have infants. And, you know, they generally work very cooperatively. So in this system, the other marmosets do have access to the infants, and then they help take care of them. And there are occasions where the non-matriarchal marmoset will also accidentally get pregnant. And then sometimes that results in infanticide, and they, but that is also something that the marmosets somehow get past, and they continue caring for each other's young.
You also talked about a case where two females had twins, so there was a subordinate female who had twins. two were suddenly lost, and it was hard to know whose children were whose, right?
Exactly. That was observed by Dr. Digby, actually, in the wild. It's very hard to observe them in the wild. And so her observation was rare and significant.
So again, all these questions that we have about biological parentage and child rearing and cooperative parenting, all of those things get pretty confused and complicated when we start looking at other species.
Absolutely, right. And you can't really draw, comparisons between human life and the human experience of reproduction with animal life, because we have so many more choices. And, sometimes those choices can make us happier, and sometimes the appearance of all of these choices can cause us some struggle.
And in your research, you also looked at the North Carolina eugenics program in particular, which was, I think, the longest living eugenics program in the country, surviving into the 70s. Tell us a bit about, you also came to know one man in particular, Willis Lynch. Maybe you can tell us his story.
Sure. So I write a little bit about the eugenics program and about Mr. Lynch in my book. And I wrote more extensively about the program and the eventually successful advocacy for compensation in a piece that I wrote for the New South, and which you can read online if you like. But I met Mr. Lynch when I started doing this research. He lives outside of Norlina in North Carolina, and had been sterilized as a boy, and not for, obviously any good reason. And he's also, he knows, and we talked about the fact that he was sterilized because he was poor. He came from a big family and he was poor. And his mother was coerced and pressured to give consent for something that she may not have fully understood. And, he found out later what had happened to him and understood for the rest of his life that he would not have children. And my circumstances are so different from Mr. Lynch's circumstances, right? I just am biologically sort of unlucky. He had a crime committed against him by the state. And yet, talking to him and spending time with him at his home, and he used to perform pretty regularly at the VFW in Norlina. He would sing and play guitar, and he's a very talented musician, very multi-talented person in general. So spending that time with him and talking to him and being able to talk to him about my fears and also to talk to him about how he has found ways to be, he's never going to be okay with what happened to him, but how he found, other paths and other purposes in his life, and how he found ways also of mentoring and being a father-like figure to other family members was just really inspiring to me. The fact that he can speak out and can be public with such a painful story is, I think, so inspiring.
We look at this, and this raises the issue, too, of unconventional families now, our broadening of our understanding of what a family can be. Still, LGBT families and people of color face some obstacles in accessing reproductive technology, right?
Yeah, I was very interested to learn and to read a couple of studies about not only the way that ART clinics or reproductive endocrinology clinics advertise. I think they're working on this problem, but many people think that there's still much more work to do.
They tend to market to middle-class white families.
They market to white families, yeah. Middle-class and upper-middle-class families. There are, I think, in a study, more than 90% of the clinics had photographs of white parents or white babies on their websites, on their home pages, and a much lower percentage had people of color. Additionally, I was interested to learn that many doctors, not probably reproductive endocrinologists, but the doctors who might be referring you to a reproductive endocrinologist, actually misidentified the characteristics of people who would be most at risk. So only, I think, 16% of doctors at the time recognized that, in fact, African Americans were more at risk for infertility than white women. And that, in fact, having less than a high school education made you more at risk for infertility. And so, you know, if doctors are not recognizing this at the, you know, primary care level, then people are obviously not getting the kinds of referrals. Then, you know, to compound this problem, ART is not something that is often covered by insurance, and it's very expensive. So it's very hard to access on a number of levels for people who live in rural communities, right? They probably live pretty far from a clinic, and traveling back and forth to the clinics is hard because you have to go, if you're in an IVF cycle, you have to go just about every other day.
You know, I've got about 10 seconds left for this question, but I wonder if this is also connected, the access question, to reproductive justice in general.
I think so. I think, you know, access is important. Access for everyone is important. Being open about, you know, about our desires and being open about choice is really important. It's reproductive justice, and it's also choice.
Talking with Bell Boggs about her new book, The Art of Waiting, on Fertility, Medicine, and Motherhood. She will be given a formal launch to her book tomorrow night at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. Festivities begin at 6. There's a reading at 7, and there's more at our website, stateofthings.org. Bell, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Just ahead, the intersection of media and pornography. We'll talk about it on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.